The scripture this morning is from Luke's Gospel, chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples began to pick some heads of grain, rubbed them in their hands, and ate the kernels, some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.' On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, 'Get up and stand in front of everyone.' So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?' He looked around at them all and then said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But they were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus." This is God's word.
We're looking at the book of Luke and the life of Jesus in the book of Luke, and for a number of weeks we've been looking at Jesus' teaching about what it means to follow him, what it means to be his disciple. And, of course, Jesus is essentially taking the gospel, who he is, what he did, and he's saying his disciples are people who apply the gospel to absolutely every single area of life. And today we come to an area that is referred to. It's covered in the fourth commandment of the Ten Commandments. It's in Exodus 20. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, for on the seventh day the Lord rested." Sabbath rest. Now, I know that that we all have somewhat different relationships to work. There are people here, for example, who are out of work and would love to have more work. There are people here who, in general, have said to me that they have a problem with work, with discipline. But by and large, in New York City, in the middle of New York City, the biggest problem we have, one of the biggest problems we have, is Sabbath rest, the discipline of, the getting of Sabbath rest. Why do we need it? Where do we get it? How do we do it? Why do we need it? Where do we get it? How do we do it? It's all here. First of all, why do we need it? Look at verse 1 to 2. Jesus and his disciples were going through a field on a Sabbath day, and they picked some heads of grain, rubbed them in their hands to eat the kernels, and they were condemned. They were accused of breaking the Sabbath by the Pharisees, and that's because reaping grain was one of the 39 forms of work that was forbidden on the Sabbath day by the halakha of the time, which is the religious regulations. And as soon as you hear that this was breaking the Sabbath, to just take the grains off, heads off of grain and rub them in your hands and get the kernels out and eat them, right away we say, how legalistic, how moralistic, all those rules, how awful. We turn up our nose at it. But notice, Jesus' response is not, "The Son of Man has come to do away with the Sabbath or to get us beyond all this." That's not what he says. He says, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath," and we'll get to that in a second. But it means at least this, that I'm all about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is what I'm all about, which means, here's what we learn to start with. The most workaholic culture in the history of the world, it's us, dare not turn up its nose at any effort, even misguided efforts, to give to people one of the things most crucial to making life even human, which is rest. Judith Shulevitz, who is a writer for the New York Times Magazine, probably New York Times Book Review, she wrote an article in New York Times Magazine just this last month, in the first week of March, called Bring Back the Sabbath. And she says this. First of all, she gives a little bit of background on herself. She says she was raised, probably in New York, I'm not sure, but she was raised in a religious community, at a synagogue. But like the average professional secular New Yorker, she resisted and basically moved away from her religious upbringing. And then she began to experience a phenomenon. Here's what she, how she describes it. She says, my mood would darken every weekend until by Saturday afternoon I'd be unresponsive and morose. My normal routine, which involved brunch with friends, made me feel impossibly restless. Then I began to do something that as a teenager, profoundly put off by her religious education, I could never have imagined ever wanting to do. I began dropping in on a nearby synagogue. Finally, I developed a theory for my condition. If formerly people suffered from the Sabbath, which means all the regulations, I now was suffering from the lack thereof. There is ample evidence that our relationship to work is out of whack. Let me argue on behalf of an institution that has kept workaholism in reasonable check for thousands of years. Most people mistakenly believe that all you have to do to stop working is to not work. But the inventors of the Sabbath understood that it was a much more complicated undertaking. You cannot downshift casually and easily. This is why the Puritan and Jewish Sabbaths were so exactingly intentional. The rules did not exist to torture the faithful. Interrupting the ceaseless round of striving requires a surprisingly strenuous act of the will, one that has to be bolstered by habit as well as by social sanction. And what she's saying is simply this. In spite of the fact she knows about, she recognizes the potential for abuse. Our relationship to work as a society is so seriously out of whack that anyone who thinks that you're going to be able to get rested by simply knocking off whenever you feel tired is hopelessly naive. The ability to rest, deeply rest, is a life or death thing. No one can do without it. But it is not natural. It is not simple. It is absolutely difficult. And it takes an enormous amount of discipline and practice. That's what she's saying. Now, why would that be? Why would it be so hard? Well, first of all, we have to look at our modern situation. I'll do that briefly. The modern situation means that the eternal human need for rest is enormously aggravated. Let me give you four trends, A, B, C, D trends. Trend one, an A trend, is the fact that more and more, at least in Western culture, jobs are insecure. The idea of, jobs hold departments. If they don't perform, if they don't turn profit, they're eliminated. Job security has, there's never been a culture, never been a place where job security was so bad, I don't think. Number two, I'm saying big things kind of in nutshells here. There's been a lot of research done on the fact that where it used to be the people making the money at the top of a company used to make maybe 10 or 20 times what people at the bottom of the company made. Now it's more like 100 to 200 times. And partly as a result of this, to some degree, increasingly people who make large amounts of money are expected to put in enormous numbers of hours. It's just expected. And if you don't want to do it, there's a line behind you. Whereas people on the bottom are having to take multiple jobs. So everybody's overworked. Doesn't matter where you are on the scale. In order to make ends meet, they have to take multiple jobs. That's B. C, technology. Ah, technology. You can work anywhere. Which means now we work everywhere. It means that you can't stop work from spilling out into every nook and cranny of your life. And that's C and D. The fourth trend, and this is a little more complex. Cultural analysts have said, and there's pretty much universal agreement on this, that whereas traditional societies said you got your meaning in life through your family. You got the meaning in life through family. And through basically fulfilling a fairly prescribed social role, either as a mother or father or brother or sister, or husband or wife, or son or daughter. And work wasn't as important in a situation like that. You just needed to find a way to make a living because family was what everything was about. But we are the first culture in history that says you define yourself by deciding what you want to be and attaining it. And then you have significance, which means that work, there's never been more psychological and social and emotional pressure on work to be either fulfilling or at least lucrative. There's never been a culture like that, which means A, B, C, D, A, B, and C, you know, mean that we are more desperately in need of rest than we ever have, less time for rest than ever. And D means we emotionally on the inside have less ability to rest and relax than we anyone ever has had, any culture's ever had. But as bad as that is, as aggravating as the modern situation is, the Sabbath is an ancient practice because there is an abiding human problem that has always been there. The Sabbath is obviously not a response to modern hecticness. There's something that's already been there. And what is that thing that's already been down there? There's something else that needs to be addressed by Sabbath. And Judith Shulevitz, and this is just a terrific article, I just want you to know, she understands what that deeper thing is when she says, quote, "When the Sabbath was still sacred, not only did drudgery give way to festivity and family gatherings and occasional worship, but the machinery of self-censorship shut down too, stilling the eternal inner murmur of self-reproach." The eternal inner murmur of self-reproach. The inner machinery. Now, what is she talking about there? Sleep experts know that in order to be restored, you don't just need amount of sleep, but depth of sleep, what they call REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And of course, they say, you know, that I think that only happens after a certain period of time. In other words, if you would take 8 1-hour naps or something like that, and you say, oh, I slept for 8 hours, the next day you'd be absolutely fatigued. Because you have to, I think, sleep a certain period of time before you go into deep sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And so it's not just so much amount of sleep, it's the depth of sleep that you need. And hear what she's saying, and what I'm saying is, there is, on the one hand, your external work, and you do need rest from physical exertion, but there is a deeper problem. There is a work underneath the work. There is an eternal inner murmur. There is an inner machinery of self-censorship. What does she mean by that? It's not guilt. It's the need to prove yourself to yourself, to others. And that work makes the other kinds of work incredibly weary. That's what brings the weariness. And that work, which is very, very difficult, you're always trying to prove yourself, you're trying to make sure that you that work, it's never enough. It's never enough. And because of that, that's rapid eye movement. Deep rest of the soul that you've got to have, or else all the vacations in the world won't help. If you take your vacations, you knock off, but you're not able to deal with that. You're not able to get that deeper rest, able to get that spiritual rest. You're going to be in fatigue all the time. So under the big rest, under the physical rest, is the need for deep spiritual rest. For example, the only good Rocky movie, the first one, the question comes to Rocky, why are you driven? Why are you doing all this performance? Why are all those trumpets blazing as you run through the streets of Little Italy in Philadelphia and go up the art museum steps? Why are you working so hard? And his answer was, I want to go the distance, then I'll know I'm not a bum. So our hero is being driven by the eternal inner murmur of self-reproach, the inner machinery. That's why he's working so hard. That's why he makes it to the top, etc. That's why he's going to burn out. That's why the other movies are going to be terrible. There is a deep need for deep soul rest, without which physical rest is not going to help you. So we need Sabbath rest. We've never needed it more than we do now, but we need it. So that's why we need it. Number one. Number two, where do we get it? Now let's look at what Jesus says. They say he's violating the Sabbath, and how does he respond? Well, he says, have you ever read that what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful for only priests to eat. And then he gave some to his companions. Now, what's interesting here is Jesus takes an incident from 1 Samuel 21, where we're told that David, when he was on run for his life, he was running for his life, he went through the tabernacle. And in the tabernacle, there is the place where the showbread, which was the bread of the presence, it was in the holy place in the tabernacle, was part of the Sabbath worship. And you were not allowed to eat it. It was part of the worship. And David ate it. And of course, as Jesus implies, he was never condemned for it. God never said there was anything wrong with what he did. He was never condemned for it at all. Now, Jesus is inviting us to think out the implications of that. If the Sabbath and worship regulations can be set aside in a pinch, but on the other hand, if there's absolutely no place anywhere in the Bible where the moral law can be set aside in a pinch, there's no place where God says, well, you were in a hurry, so committing adultery is all right, worshiping an idol is all right, stealing, robbing, armed robbery, that was all right, you were in trouble, if there's no place ever where the moral law is set aside in a pinch, but the Sabbath and the ceremonial and the worship regulations are set aside in a pinch, what does this mean? Think of the reasoning. It means that they are provisional. Meaning that means they're temporary. Meaning that they will end when something comes along that makes them obsolete, to which they point. And what would that be? He says, the very, very next verse. Then Jesus said to them, assuming that they're thinking along these lines, I am Lord of the Sabbath, which is astounding. Let me just say, let's think about what he's saying. He's saying actually quite more things than I'm going to be able to open up in this sermon, but he's saying this. I am the one that the Sabbath regulations all pointed to. I can give you the deep rest of the soul that you most need. I am the Lord of rest. Jesus says, I am the Lord of rest. And you know what this means two ways. If you want rest, you have to go to him. And if you think you've gone to him, but you don't have any rest, you still don't know what you have. You still haven't taken hold of what you have. You still haven't understood what you have. Now, how is he the Lord of rest and why? All right. Let me take you to a couple other verses that are important. What does this mean that he's Lord of rest? What does it mean to give you rest? First of all, let's go to the original verse in the Bible about this. You go all the way back to Genesis 1, the end of Genesis 1, the beginning of Genesis 2, and God has just finished creating the world. And this is what we read. And God saw that all he had created, and God saw that all he had made, it was good. And God finished the work he had been doing so that on the seventh day he rested from his work. God rested, seventh day, right? But what do you mean God rested? Was he tired? God can't be tired. And if God can't be tired, what in the world does it mean he's rested? You and I can define rest as getting over being tired. What does it mean that God rested if he wasn't tired? And here's the answer. One of the things that's so neat about the creation account is every time God makes something, before he moves on to something else, he says something over and over and over again. You know what it is? He makes something and he looks at it and he says, that's good. That was good. Then he makes something else and he says, that's good. And then when he gets to the very end, which I just read, he looks at all of it and he says, very good. And that's what it means to rest. To be utterly satisfied with what's been done. To be utterly satisfied. That's the only way you can walk away. That's the only way you can stop. The only way you can put your doing down is if you're absolutely satisfied with the doing. That's good. That is good. Now you can rest. Now you can relax. So you see, the definition of resting is to be utterly satisfied with what was done. Second verse. Scroll forward. Hebrews chapter 4. It's talking about the gospel. The Hebrews writer is talking to Christians about what it means to believe in Jesus. And as he's talking about the gospel and believing in Jesus, suddenly he says this. There remains then a rest for the people of God. For anyone who, through the gospel, enters God's rest, rests from his own work just as God rested from his. Now this is an amazing statement. What does it mean to become a Christian? I mean, there's a whole lot of ways of putting it. And the reason you need every different way is because you need them all to understand the richness of it. To become a Christian is someone who's able to look at your work the way God looked at his. Able to look at your life the way God looked at his. You're being told here that through Jesus Christ, you can look at your life, you can look at yourself and say, it's absolutely satisfying. It's absolutely good. There's nothing else that needs to be done. It is good. All the work that I need to do is finished. How could that be? How is that possible? But you see, look, Judith Shulevitz, one more time, I'm going to go back to her one more time because it's such a great article. She gives us insight, and she puts it like this. And this is great. She says, not even our group leisure activities can do for us what the Sabbath rituals could once be counted on to do. Hear that? She says, it's not enough for you to just knock off and go on out there and do all your leisure activity. That's not going to give you the rest from the eternal inner murmur and inner machinery. Oh, no. She says, not even our group leisure activities can do for us what Sabbath rituals could once be counted on to do. Because religious rituals do not exist simply to promote togetherness. They are designed to convey to us a story about who we are. The story told by the Sabbath is of creation. God rested, and we rest in order to honor the image of the divine in us, to remind us that there's more to us than our work. Now, she, to a great degree, has discerned exactly what the Hebrews writer is trying to say. Remember we said there's a work underneath as well as a work up here. There's a physical work, but the thing that makes things really really weary is not the physical work. Because, listen, you go back into the book of Genesis, you go back to paradise, go to the Garden of Eden, and there was work there.